This is Radio EcoShock with Alex Smith.
Across our world.
Did the pandemic lockdowns and the move to online life at least help us cut our climate-killing emissions? From Beijing, new science led by our guest Dr. Zhu Liu provides unexpected answers. Then Canadian scientist Megan K. Young explains why extreme rains and floods are popping up all over. But first, can climate change drive humans to extinction? Three international guests this week on Radio EcoShock.
Radio EcoShock.
Could we drive ourselves to extinction by changing the climate? The Extinction Rebellion movement protests our continuing push towards rapid climate change. But is that really a possibility for us? New science finds our earlier cousins, a half dozen other types of humans, were driven towards extinction mainly by climate change. We need to know how that works. Dr. Pasquale Raya has investigated the role of climate in mammals, including humans. He is lead author of the new paper, Past Extinctions of Homo Species Coincided with Increased Vulnerability to Climatic Change. Pasquale is associate professor at Università di Napoli, Federico II in Italy, and leader at Raya's lab. From Naples, Pasquale, welcome to Radio EcoShock.
Nice to meet you, Alex, and your audience.
So, compared to other species surviving in nature for many millions of years, it seems that humans and our hominid relatives are pretty short-lived, almost experimental. Why do you think that is?
Well, in a sense, it's not exactly like that, because in paleontology, we refer to species as units that we recognize as such because they are morphologically stable. So if a lineage does change in morphology faster than other lineage, you happen to recognize more species. But in fact, there is no speciation event. It's just the shapes that change. Maybe this is the case with humans as well.
For most of the public, talk about extinction seems unreal, almost a joke. But when science looks back, we find other human types that had tools, they had fire and a society, but they disappeared. So can we legitimately talk about climate change and extinction?
Yeah, of course, climate change is one of the main factors driving species extinct. And what we found is basically that the same fate befall on humans as well.
And I worry the public has too simple a picture of how that might happen. Our end might come not simply because it's too hot for us to work or be outside or even extreme weather, but maybe species we depend on will go extinct, maybe in the food chain or even species we have in our guts to digest food. What do you think?
Well, of course, we don't know about the actual mechanism. What is true with climate change is that when the climate changes, the vegetation change, the food change, and the vegetable matter that you use to consume may change, so you really don't find any food to make a living. And what most species usually do in this condition, I mean, when climate change, is to track the ideal condition, their vegetation as it moves, depending on the changing temperatures and rainfall. But this is not always possible. And when this becomes impossible to do, physically impossible to do, for example, when you are confined on an island, the climate change could really drive you extinct. And this seems to have happened to some of the human species we studied.
Well, perhaps we should get an introduction to the different types of humans. Can we call them humans? Are all these species called human beings?
Yes, absolutely. All of the species that belong to the genus Homo are actually recognized as human.
And did humans begin with chimpanzees? And how many species of the genus Homo have been found?
Oh, it depends on how many species actually are recognized, but it's half a dozen for sure, and probably many more than that.
Did we seem to evolve from chimpanzees?
Absolutely. This is a truism. It's not even debatable.
And we're still finding new variations. Tell us about the small humans discovered in Indonesia in 2004.
And there is yet another species that has been found last year in the Philippines. So it's actually two of them. I mean, speaking of small insular species, that species evolve on islands to become small. It is not uncommon. It's very common among large mammals. In the latest Pleistocene, you find a plethora of small mammals like that. You find small elephants in the Channel Islands in California, a lot of small elephants in the Mediterranean, and the same goes for deer and hippos, even in Madagascar and in the Sunda Shelf. So it's basically a quite common phenomenon that we refer to as the island rule. And these two small human species are just two more on the count.
And I'm presuming from the small number of individuals that have been found of those that we call the hobbits, or some people call the hobbits, they were only just above 3 feet tall. Can we really say anything about why they went extinct using the big methods that you had to employ in your paper?
Oh, yeah. It's very, very common for small insular species to become extinct once the island, once the sea level drops and the island becomes connected again to the mainland, because the large continental relatives of these species actually invade the formerly insular environment, and they are, from the competition point of view, they are much better than the small insular form, and they just become extinct.
Now, the most drastic climate changes in the last few million years were the ice ages, which buried much of the northern hemisphere in deep glaciers. Based on your work so far, is global cooling a more prominent cause of extinction of humans than global warming?
So far as we can tell, it's just global cooling. Global warming is a much recent phenomenon. It's quite uncommon during the last 5 million years. What we are experiencing right now is a global warming, and the consequences, not on humans, but on all other beings, are terrible, as you know. Speaking of humans, only of them, it's just cooling events that drove them extinct in the end.
So far.
So far. Okay, that's fine.
Your new study depends partly on a relatively new development called a climate emulator. What is that, briefly, and how reliable is it?
Okay, basically, major currents in the oceans and in the atmosphere do follow physical laws, and they have some regularity. So you can study them in the past, and you can, once you acquire, so to speak, the laws, the rules of the game, you can project these major currents, the circulations, the direction, and the drops and the increase in temperatures in the future, with basing on the same set of rules. So there is uncertainty, of course, that basically depends on how regular all of these patterns are. But you can trust them for the most.
Let's talk about one of the earlier types of humans, Homo erectus. What were they like, and did they live at the same time as we Homo sapiens?
Homo erectus is a much older species than we are. It sprang out in Africa some 2 million years ago, and it was the first species of Homo to venture outside Africa. At some a little less than 2 million years ago, there is a hugely important site in Georgia, Caucasus, with the first findings of Homo erectus outside Africa.
But did they live at the same time as we did?
No, absolutely not. It's an older species.
So what indications did you find that climate change may have triggered the extinction of Homo erectus?
So basically, by using the emulator and the fossil record, we we modeled the climatic niche requirement of these species. It basically means which kind of temperature range they can live in, which kind of rainfall range they can live in, which kind of environment, so to speak. And once we had this picture for all of these species, we can study time period by time period how the conditions were changing and how suitable, so to speak, the environment was for them. And what we found is that for the three extinct species we referred to in the paper, the climatic change was just too much and too extreme just before extinction. And from that point, we applied an analysis which is basically developed for conservation studies, which tells you how much vulnerable the species will be to climate change in the future. And by applying this technique to the Homo species, we found that all of them, all of the extinct species, were actually made vulnerable by climate change just before extinction.
Probably our best-known relatives are the Neanderthals, and they did live at the time when humans, modern humans, were on the Earth. When did Neanderthals go extinct and why?
It went extinct some 40,000 years ago. This estimation is quite precise because there is good technique to have a good absolute age reference. So it's like that. It's 40,000 years ago. The reason, it's not simple to identify the exact reason. For sure, we were part of the equation. But what we found in that paper you were referring to and in other previous papers is that climate change matters to the extinction of Neanderthals probably more than the presence of humans. And besides that, all of the evidence we have about how Neanderthals coexisted with humans is not pointing to anything dramatically violent or anything like that. In fact, we have Neanderthal DNA in our genes.
And I know some listeners have heard of the Toba theory, suggesting humans were reduced to a few thousand individuals during a volcanic eruption in Indonesia. But recently, some scientists discount that. What do you think, Pasquale?
You know, things like that do matter. They can have dramatic consequences on species, but by the end of the day, it came out that Toba eruption, no matter how big it was huge, but no matter how big it was, doesn't coincide in terms of age with the extinction of Neanderthals. So its effect on Neanderthal survival could have been limited at best.
You are tuned to Radio EcoShock. I'm Alex Smith. Our guest from Napoli, Italy, is Professor Pasquale Raia. We are talking about the reasons previous humans went extinct. You know, we presume the impact of large changes in climate, such as warming or the arrival of another ice age, would also depend heavily on where the species was located at the time. For example, those living in Africa would be less impacted than in Europe, where that froze over. Is that a real factor?
Yeah, absolutely, because the more you get closer to the equator, the less variable the climate will be in the future. And it was like that in the past as well. So it depends a lot on how far you are from the poles. The closer you are to the poles, the more dramatic the consequences of climate change would be.
You and your co-authors, 15 in all, ask this fundamental question: is there a single climate change-induced extinction trajectory for all Homo? And your answer so far to that is?
Yes.
So how do you know that?
It's just because, as I was telling before, it's just because when we sized up the potential extinction risk brought about by climate change on these species, all of them, we found that all of them were much more vulnerable to climate change than humans. By humans, at this time, I mean Homo sapiens. They were experiencing less climatic variation than ever before during the last time period of their existence. And in addition, the effect of climate change must have been large on them.
Now, with Neanderthals, you touched on the idea of competition as a factor. How do you know that climate change was the main driver rather than competition for all these different types of humans?
But in the case of Neanderthals, we have had exchange with them. We know that Neanderthals used to, in some places, in some time periods, we know that Neanderthals used to imitate the technology of Homo sapiens. We know that there has been a lot of genetic flow between the two species, which mean mating, and a lot of there is a lot of DNA in our genes as well, outside Africa at least. And in addition, there is very, very limited, and I'd say no evidence of violent interaction between the two species. And those are all facts. And in addition, now we know that Neanderthals were much more vulnerable to climate change than Homo sapiens was.
In the logic of your new paper, you assume if we rule out competition as a driver of extinction, with maybe a possible half-exemption of the Neanderthals, then the species ender must be climate change. But in these times of pandemic, perhaps there could be other causes, like a disease wiping out a species. Can we say that did not happen?
Yes, because the dynamic of pandemics is very well known. During a pandemic outbreak, what can really happen is that a large percentage, to speak, of the population could be actually wiped out, but there are genetically resistant individuals. This has been true for all the pandemics that hit on the human population in the past, and there is no reason to believe that for these species were anything different. And in addition to that, there is not a single species I can recall that has been wiped out by a pandemic.
So I think a lot of our listeners will assume with our advanced technology that this past theory of human extinction may not apply. Have we gone beyond the rules of climate limits to survival?
I guess this is a reasonable assumption. The point is that maybe we have enough technology, and we will have enough technology in the future to withstand even the harshest of climate change. But the point is that all other critters on Earth have not this same commodity. So it's actually, you know, we have to decide if we want to live in a world of happiness with other species and to see the natural world outside our cities, or do we want to live alone? And I'd vote for the first. What do you do?
Well, I'm not too sure, because this climate change is coming so rapidly that there could be unknowns like our food supply and other species that we depend on. Perhaps we could become extinct. I don't know. So in the last couple of centuries, we have Homo sapiens becoming larger. I have to duck when I go into an English medieval inn. The doors are so short. And only recently, people in Japan and China are getting taller. And as we know, in America and parts of Europe, humans are getting heavier. They're over 300 pounds, some, or even over 600 pounds. Pasquale, you've studied how and why mammals become larger. Does your research into mammal size tell us anything about why this is happening to our bodies these days?
Well, this was one of my research lines in the past and still is now. On a very long time scale, mammal do become larger. This is not exclusive of mammals. A lot of species do that. A lot of species groups do that over a very long time scale. And this a good explanation for that could be that on the level of competition, larger individuals are better at competition than smaller individuals. That's quite obvious to imagine, and it seems to work as a mechanism. Getting back to humans, it really may be that there is no real selection, natural selection, or genetic change either, causing human populations to grow larger during development. What is changed for sure is the quality of the food we receive during growth. And we know for a fact that this makes people taller.
So survival in a changing climate was depending on the ability to adapt with things like tools and clothes. I think clothes are very important. Could we say the development of technology itself may also have been stimulated by changes in the climate?
Absolutely, yes. Absolutely, yes. In terms of the rapidity, the rate of technological innovation, cultural exchange, and stimulation by the environment are the two main factors. And by stimulation by the environment, I mean basically climate change.
Pas Raya, what are you working on now?
Well, you know, I'm happy to say I have a paper out right now. We tried to understand when and how humans became able to live in environments that were either too cold or too warm or too humid or the opposite for us to live, because that is to do that you need technology, you need culture in a very broad sense. And we found that we are not the only species, we Homo sapiens are not the only species within our genus that had this ability in the past. There are at least other two human species that were able to do that, which is Neanderthals and Homo heidelbergensis.
Yes, I was reading in your paper about those, and some were better adapted to a hot, humid climate, and I was thinking, well, if they had survived to the present day, maybe they would do even better during rapid climate change.
Oh, that makes a lot of sense. That makes a lot of sense. Homo erectus is the one.
Yeah.
It was the best adapted to warm and humid climates. It will thrive now.
So the bottom line, do you think that even with our sophisticated technology, is it your feelings that humans may create a climate shift that could drive us to extinction as well?
I don't think it can drive us extinct, but for sure, I'm pretty sure that it will drive us miserable in the future, and with much less people around on Earth.
Well, climate projections show that climate change will be particularly harsh on Italy, driving you towards an almost North African living. I think that should speak to the people of your country for sure.
I'm trying to do that, and they have a day fair, usually.
Well, that's true around the world, unfortunately, but perhaps science will break through eventually. From the Università di Napoli, Italy, we have been speaking with Professor Pasquale Raia. Find links to the science we've been talking about in my show blog at ecoshock.org. Pasquale, thank you for your work and helping us to understand our place in time.
It has been great talking with you, Alex, and my greetings to the people on the audience.
I'm Alex Smith for Radio EcoShock.
If you have a story idea or thoughts on something you've heard, contact us, radio@ecoshock.org. That's radio@ecoshock.org. You're listening to EcoShock Radio for the world.
I'm Alex Smith. Get it all at our website, ecoshock.org. When the developed world was forced into a temporary shutdown by the COVID-19 pandemic, emissions of climate-shifting greenhouse gases also slowed down. What does that tell us? Is it enough to change our trajectory towards terrible warming and extreme weather? A new study tracks the carbon slowdown, the rebound, and adds up the possibilities for climate change. The lead author is Dr. Xu Liu from the Department of Earth System Science at Tsinghua University in Beijing, China. This Harvard scholar has won multiple awards in the United States and China for his climate research. From Beijing, Xu Liu, welcome to Radio EcoShock.
Thank you. Yeah, my pleasure to introduce my work.
So environmentalists have been quietly hoping that these painful lockdowns from COVID-19 would at least offer a glimmer of hope for a lower carbon future later. What brought you and your associates from the Potsdam Institute to look for a better way to calculate the impact of the pandemic on greenhouse gas emissions?
Yeah, basically we have observed the dramatic change of the emissions that associate with human activities. So basically, when the pandemic happens, as you can see, that there's a shutdown measure by government and people's activities are limited by a lot. So everybody wonder if there's a huge impact in terms of environment consequences. And obviously, we can predict there's a huge decline of the CO2 emissions that associate with, for example, energy consumption, for example, the transportation. And so we try to build up this so-called real-time or near-real-time data set to capture this change.
Where were the big reductions happening during the pandemic response?
Basically, when the pandemic happens, the most obvious change is like everybody stopped to travel and to go outside, and most of the time, people stay at home. So we can see the most and the largest impact happened on the transportation sector, that the emission on the transportation sector declined a lot, especially for the international flights. We can see that has decreased, for example, by 90%, and they still haven't recovered so far.
We all use concrete for building, and unknown to the public, I think, the cement industry is responsible for a significant amount of greenhouse gases. What happened in that industry as the economy closed to control the spread of the virus?
Yeah, for most kinds of heavy industry, like the cement industry, like steel industry, they also been affected by a lot. We have observed and captured this kind of obvious decline of the emission in industry like cement and steel. But the impact for this heavy industry is not so obvious when compared with transportation, when compared with power generation, because those sectors are, for example, the power and the transportation are more directly related with the human activities. And for the cement, for the steel industry, it's more like, you know, it's kind of they need to operate for quite a long time, and it's not easy to directly shut down them. Maybe there's a limit for the production, for example, as not so much worker working like as normal as during the pandemic. But they do have some kind of an impact, like they have declined the operation for some extent. But generally, the impact for the cement for the production, for the steel production, are not so obvious when compared with other sectors.
Okay, I just want to get in a note here for listeners to remind everyone that lower emissions in early 2020 does not mean humans stopped creating massive changes to the atmosphere. I mean, according to your paper, emissions dropped by about 8.8% in the first 6 months of the pandemic, but that still means humans added 91.2% of the greenhouse gases released into the atmosphere in the same period in 2019, and we're already producing almost double the emissions that we did in the year 2000. Did we just take our foot off the gas a little, but still driving towards this climate predicament?
Yeah, I think that's a very important point here. Like, we still produced a lot, a huge amount of carbon dioxide that is generated and released to the atmosphere, and we still keep warming, keep our climate more into a more dangerous level. It's only like during the pandemic, because of decline of the emission, we only slow down a little bit. Yeah, that's a very small part, a little bit. Although this is already like in history, on record, the largest decline of the emission by human activities, but it's only like slow a little bit about the drivers of the climate change, which is the greenhouse gas emissions. So the impact of the decline of the greenhouse gases, the decline of the carbon dioxide associated with such pandemic only introduced about 0.1 ppm decline of the CO2 concentration in the atmosphere. Right now we have a 410 ppm concentration of the CO2 in the atmosphere, and such a pandemic only introduced decline of 0.1 ppm. So that's very small part. And the impact for the whole climate change is very limited. We cannot say like we, because of the pandemic, we already, maybe because this one, but we got a chance to solve another one. It's not the case. The real case is we have a double challenge here. The first one, the climate change for the long term, and right now we have the COVID challenge for the short term. And we do have seen some opportunity here. For example, if the human activity can result in the kind of a low emission level, and after the green recovery we still keep this emission level, then maybe we have a chance to peak the CO2 emission of human beings. Yeah, start from this year, and in the following years, we see that the emission decline.
Well, that's the dream, and we will see. Now, in late October, just now, many countries in Europe, including the UK, shut down again due to a second wave of coronavirus, can we expect the portion of lockdown-dependent emissions will follow the ups and downs of the disease?
I think based on the data set we observed, we can expect a kind of another decline of the emission. As we have observed in many cities, that actually the emission, because the CO2 emission is highly related with human activity, so once there are reported a new case or reported a rapid increase of the cases, then we see the emission decline. This is simultaneously associated with how many cases being reported. So if there's a second wave, or if there's a kind of a, even without lockdown measures, if there's a second wave of the pandemic, then we probably will see the decline of the emission again.
You are tuned to Radio EcoShock from Beijing. Our guest is Zhu Liu, and we are talking about whether the shutdowns have really helped us to reduce our carbon emissions and maybe helped us a little towards climate change. Now, it's kind of amazing that we can even know what is happening so close to the present with emissions. Why have previous techniques been so slow to capture such fast-moving changes that happened, like during a pandemic?
There are two reasons, basically. First one is the data. So basically, the big data technology and also the data set itself developed very rapidly in the last, 5 years. So before that, we haven't seen so much data, and we don't have sufficient data to analyze the issue like change of the emission due to the COVID. And the second reason is that COVID itself, it also introduced a change of the research style. So you can see that from the traditional measure, they don't have the resolution, and they don't have the urgent need to have the, for example, temporal resolution up to daily. So if they use a traditional measure, we cannot capture such kind of a change. But they will really need the analysis, like the measures, to look at those highly temporal resolution data sets. And this only through this way we can look through the change of the emissions due to the COVID.
Could you please tell us what the organization Carbon Monitor is and how they contributed to your new study?
Yeah, we have a very international team. Work together, we have a scientist from France, U.S., and my own team work at Tsinghua University. So we basically collected the data worldwide, covered all sectors from the industry to power generation to the transportation, including the ground transportation and the flights and the ships. And also we have looked at the household consumption data, basically covered all sectors that generated the CO2 emission. And we try to look at those high spatial and temporal resolution data. Basically, we have dig out the hourly or sub-hourly data sets and to build up. That's a huge data, but very precise and kind of a very timely data set. Through this data set, we can basically capture the kind of a near real-time change of the emissions. Basically, the data sets are composed by the near real-time data of human activities. So throughout that, we build up those total emission numbers, but the numbers represent the near real-time activities by human beings.
And you can even track things like traffic in various cities around the world.
Yeah, basically the ground transportation data sets are composed by the so-called the mobility index from the different cities. So basically they have showing how much of the cars, how long distance travel with of cars within a city, and that's for the ground transportation. And we have, for example, the aviation data set that covered all the domestic and international flights in terms of how many flights currently, in each individual time flights and how long distance they have been traveled.
So how did your team use figures for air pollution to cross-check your results? What does air pollution tell us about greenhouse gas emissions? I mean, they're different.
There are some kind of a common features and difference between the greenhouse gas emissions and other air pollution issues. For the other air pollution species, they also need like a technical and a transformation model to further analyze it. But we do compare with the carbon dioxide with NO2. So basically, because these two species are most close to each other in terms of the emission sources, so the satellite image here being used. So basically, we use a satellite observation to look at the air pollution and to compare with the change of the carbon dioxide.
So did your study include things like black carbon and the various nitrogen compounds that are warming gases?
No, right now it's only the carbon dioxide, but later we will include more species, and it's currently ongoing work.
Just as an example of the kind of thing we can get from Carbon Monitor, could you tell us anything about the emissions profile so far for India during the pandemic there?
Yeah, let me just open the website. Yeah. Even we prepare this data, we need a carefully look at it, because the website also updates basically we only have a 1 month lag. So basically we update the data every month. And when the paper published, it's still not the kind of most updated one. But for India, yes, we have a showing the website that updates to end of August. Yeah, we have still seen, like, for example, for different sectors, we have seen, like, there is still, for all sectors, there's a decline of 13.4% of total emission. So that's for the data for India.
In your paper, you mentioned holidays like Christmas in the West or Spring Festival in China, when millions of people travel to be with their families. But contrary to what I expected, you find emissions are actually lower during those big travel events. Why is that?
Yeah, yes, because the travel for the, like, individually, the travel, the kind of for the individual people, the associated emission is still lower than what people go for work. So basically, during the holiday, most of the industry also, like, decrease their activities. And that's a major part. And for the ground transportation, we see also, like, this, the people, like, drive for work as much more than the people drive for the holiday travel. So if the most of people, they don't drive for work, probably, if they drive for work, probably, like, for each single family and, for example, different members or the family, they drive their individual cars. And if they drive for the holiday, they probably drive together. So they actually, in terms of total amount of the emissions, they actually were showing a decrease. And it's very common across all the country. Like in Western countries, you see that without the pandemic, you see that the Christmas as a date, that's the lowest emission. And for example, for China, we see the Spring Festival and also the National Day holiday will be the day with lowest amount of the daily emission.
The winter of 2019-20, last winter, was exceptionally warm in the Northern Hemisphere. How did that affect your calculations of carbon emissions?
Yeah, this is a factor, the weather factor we need to kind of considered, because if there's a warm temperature, then there will be less consumption of natural gas, basically for the heating, especially for spring and for winter. And the heating is one of the major sources for the emissions that from the household consumption. So if there's warm, for example, warm spring this year, and we've already seen the emission decline before the COVID. And such impacts should be considered, because that decline has nothing related with COVID. It's only because there's less natural consumption start from that.
Xu Lu, why were greenhouse gas emissions from China actually higher in May 2020 than in 2019, despite the lockdown?
That's because China has made very rigorous lockdown measures. And it's so far very effectively controlled the disease. So they have China have, for example, started the lockdown measures since end of January. But in like March, if I remember right, they already released the lockdown measures, and most of cities, the people's daily life come back to normal. So we have seen, and even because there is kind of a decrease of the industrial output at the February and like March and April. So start from May, that's once we want to keep the normal operation of the industry, probably those industrial output need to like generate more products to, you know, to like meet up the decline. And you will see like a bit kind of a rebound, but it's not so significant. But it's still from the data, you see that industrial output from the May are kind of higher than the previous one.
I found that your paper more or less assumed that we will rebound to what we might call normal growth. But what happens if emissions go way down during a global economic recession comparable to the 1930s or worse?
Yeah, that's one case. We still don't know what like the full picture this year because there's still 2 months. And for the future long-term trend, it's entirely unknown. We don't know how long this pandemic could last and the people living such way that with different pattern, entirely different compared with our previous life. And we don't know if our recovery plan governments then can kind of green enough to support our current level of the low emission. So that's entirely unknown. But I hope the data sets we provide and also those research framework we provide could capture and keep monitor such trend in the future.
You know, in the past 2 years, I've seen an incredible increase in the number of papers led by Chinese scholars, and the power of climate study seems to have shifted towards China. What is the policy of the government of China regarding climate change and climate research?
I think that China always wants to have the kind of environment-friendly policy. From the last decades, China have a dramatic increase on the people's life quality, on the economic development. And we see a lot of issues related with like increasing of the environment pressures. So there is a government has to think about, and there is also a willingness to improve our environment and to enhance the environment protections, whatever it's domestically or as globally. And the researchers, of course, have like always have interest to look at what the change of our planet from the local level to the global level. And here, as China becomes the world top CO2 emitter, then will become like more and more scientists will focus on, like, for example, the environment issues and also how China could achieve low carbon.
The United States, under Donald Trump, issued a notice to withdraw from the only international reduction plan we have so far, the Paris Agreement of 2015. What is the position of the Chinese government on the Paris Agreement?
China definitely wants to do their efforts to contribute to the Paris Agreement. You know, just within this month, the President Xi Jinping has announced that China will peak early compared with the previous committee commitment to peak its total emission by 2030, and China will peak early than that. And he further promised that China will go to the carbon neutral by 2060. So that's already a very big step, and I think that's very ambitious and broad step. But definitely a lot of efforts, like China is such a huge country, and the industrialization process only happened in last, 30 or 40 years. So that's very short time compared with those Western countries. And now China wants to go to the kind of zero emission by 2050. So that's a very short time, and to make this transition is definitely a big challenge, but it's really good news for the world that the world's largest, the world country's largest energy consumption and CO2 emission want to do their efforts to combine to fight with climate change.
All right, now this next question is a bit complex, but it appears the United States capped emissions partly by exporting production of products to China. But in 2013, you co-authored a paper about how China itself began to outsource its emissions, and it seems like global emissions travel to less developed countries, and that kind of distorts the whole system of carbon accounting when you only do it country by country. I'm wondering if we'll have to make a change in the idea of national plans in the Paris Accord towards a more global picture, the kind of picture that comes out of your new study.
Yeah. This is a normal trend, like during the improvement of lifestyle, like improvement of life quality for the developing country. So basically the developing country become rich, then they will become, like they will also become the high standard consumer. So they will consume the product that generates worldwide. So we see those kind of a so-called outsourcing or so-called embodied emission issues. That issue actually told us that if we want to really solve the climate change issue, we really need the globally, the kind of everybody, every country, everybody, each single one to do their efforts. Because if you do not control the emission by yourself, then through the outsourcing, then you probably become another source to contribute to a lot on the emission, and that's bad for the whole world.
Xu Liu, if a wrenching shutdown of business and personal lives is not enough to stop global warming, what do we have to do? Could you explain what the results of your new study imply for the kind of climate action we really need?
Oh yeah, that's from the kind of our study by like a provider of day by day data set, we see even like the pandemic events like such strong influence on the human lifestyle, like most of people stay at home. We only see like up to 10% decline of the emission that we generate to the atmosphere. So here there's a urgent needs for the action. We need to reduce our emission by zero, okay, as like no emission, and we stop to kind of get the climate change worse. And we also need negative emission probably in the future, like to make this as really a cure of the issue. But right now, even with like lots of people that lose jobs, if with lots of people stay at home and like they don't have too much activities, we only observed, for example, the 10% of the decline of the emission. And that exactly told us like how serious such challenge is and how big scale the challenge we are facing with.
What do you think are the biggest questions climate science still needs to solve?
We have many. And for the scientists, we still have huge uncertainties in terms of, for example, how fast we need to take action and to what extent we would need, for example, the carbon capture technology, the carbon removal technology, and what the costs associated with that. Can the world afford, can the cost affordable, can the government have the ability to afford the cost, and will like the government really take the actions as quick as we need to solve this issue? And all of these are still unknown, is still the big challenge for us.
We have been speaking with Dr. Xu Liu from Harvard and Tsinghua University, and you can follow up links to our discussion in my weekly show blog published Wednesdays at ecoshock.org. Thank you so much for sharing your work with us.
Thank you very much. It's my pleasure.
I'm Alex Smith for Radio EcoShock.
Check out the Radio EcoShock website. We're at ecoshock.org.
Astounding amounts of rain drown a city or a region, setting records and starting floods with widespread damage. We hear of it again and again. Is it just because news loves the weather porn, or have humans really created more extreme rain and snowfall events? A new paper from Canadian scientists answers that question for you. The research article, Human Influence Has Intensified Extreme Precipitation in North America, was published June 2020 in the Proceedings of the National Academy of Sciences. The lead author is Dr. Megan Kirchmeyer-Young from the Climate Research Division of Environment and Climate Change Canada. From Toronto, Megan Kirchmeyer-Young, welcome to Radio EcoShock.
Hi, thanks for having me.
We see nightly news of heavy rainstorms from the Gulf of Mexico running up to New England and Canada. These are not just hurricanes or tropical storms like Cristobal. Megan, have extreme rainfall events increased since the oldsters grew up in the 1950s and 60s?
Yes, we have found that heavy rainfall has increased across North America, and this is largely due to global warming.
And it's not just a small twist in the weather, is it? My New England listeners will remember in August 2011, Hurricane Irene hung around and around, and it rained into floods and millions of dollars in damages. How serious a challenge is the increase of extreme rains or snow events?
Well, heavy rainfall is a major factor contributing to flash flooding, especially in urban areas. And we do expect a continued increase in the frequency and severity of extreme rainfall with continued global warming. And so urban flash flooding may become an increasing concern.
Is more rain actually falling in North America each year, or is it the same amount of rain falling in a shorter period of time in bursts?
So we focus on the annual maximum, or the largest rainfall event each year. And this is a very common way to represent extreme precipitation. We're finding that the largest rainfall event each year is becoming larger, so there's more rainfall in that event. Or you can also think of this as a rainfall event over a particular magnitude is happening more often.
According to the U.S. Fourth National Climate Assessment, the distribution of increased rain and snow is not even across the United States. What parts of North America are getting drier, and what regions are prone to getting even more extreme precipitation events as the world warms?
So we are seeing the strongest increases in heavy rainfall in eastern North America. These regions also see the strongest increasing trends when we look out into the future.
Yeah, it's interesting. When you have an area that's in drought, like the U.S. Southwest or in California, then when you do get an extreme rainfall event, the flooding can be worse because the ground's all hard, there's no place for the water to go, and you get even worse floods.
Yes, definitely. This is what we consider a compound event. One extreme, a drought, immediately followed by a different extreme, heavy rainfall, and those occurring together can result in an even bigger impact than either one may have had on its own. And compound events are very much an emerging area of research in climate science. I think we'll see a lot more attention on these type of events.
Why can't scientists make specific predictions about rainfall in major cities like New York, Los Angeles, or Toronto?
So extreme precipitation varies a lot from place to place. If you think about a heavy rainfall from your memory, there's very heavy rainfall in one location, and you may go not that far away, and there's much less rainfall. So because of this variability, it can be very difficult to assess extreme precipitation on a very small scale, like a single point or a city location. That's very small scale.
From references in your paper, it looks like scientists found human influence in floods that happened in Alberta, the Netherlands, Louisiana, and in the south of France. But some floods in Australia, the Danube in Europe, and India don't look like they did have climate causes. Why is human influence found in some big floods but not others?
So for any specific event, there are lots of factors that contribute to the occurrence of that event. One of those factors is the weather and climate, and one of those factors could be human influence. But there is a lot else going on. And so it depends a lot on the specific event. Flooding can be especially challenging because there are a lot of factors involved, and how those factors interact matters. If there's heavy rainfall, if there's an increase in heavy rainfall, that could make a flood more likely. But how much snowpack is on the ground, how much snowpack is upstream, how much the river is managed by humans in terms of the flow, how big of a catchment there is flowing into that river, all of that can play a role in whether there's a flood. A lot of event attribution studies, what you're referring to, they start looking at the rainfall component. And so even if they can say that human influence has made the rainfall component of this flood more likely, there's still lots of factors that can be more challenging to assess.
After the year 2005, in your paper, your numbers assume, I think, the RCP 8.5 pathway, which is, it's the worst climate outcome, but it's also our current direction, really. Why did you do that?
RCP 8.5 is what is available for these large ensembles of climate models. But RCP 8.5 is one of the most used climate simulations from the CMIP-5. A lot of papers on climate science will have used this scenario. It does represent, in general, a high end, and it is considered a no climate policy, no mitigation scenario. It can be very helpful to see sort of a higher end of what we might expect.
I'm wondering if you could explain this statement from the study, which seemed to me pretty important. It says, most regions exhibit large reductions in return periods of extreme events with greater than 1 degree C of warming. Why are the return periods important?
So a return period is a way to talk about the frequency of the event. So perhaps you're familiar with the terminology of like the 100-year event. And so this just means an event that occurs on average about every 100 years. And so we find that in a world without any human influence on the climate, that 100-year event would occur on average every 20 years at 1 degree warming with human influence. And that is, 1 degree is about where we are in our current climate. That same event goes up to about every 5 years on average if we increase to 2 degrees of global warming from pre-industrial.
In the American Northeast and big cities of eastern Canada, city infrastructure was built in the early 1900s when extreme precipitation events were less likely. What does your new study and a wetter future mean for government spending on infrastructure upgrades?
So a lot of infrastructure can be impacted by heavy rainfall. And as you noted, a lot of this infrastructure was designed based on historical values. And so going forward, the impacts of increases in extreme rainfall should be considered when thinking about what it means for the infrastructure and what types of storms we should be considering designing for.
The IPCC seems to set an upward limit of about 3 degrees C of warming above pre-industrial temperatures as a pretty bad and worst-case scenario, but there have been conferences like 4 degrees and beyond that have considered we might go further, and science is pretty conservative in its views. Is it possible that your study results could still be underestimates?
In terms of how much we warm, that depends a lot on what choices we make right now and in the near future in terms of emissions. I think it is very useful to assess climate changes in extreme precipitation at many different levels of global warming. It's useful to see what might happen. That can help us decide in terms of how much we want to mitigate, or it can help us prepare in terms of what we might need to adapt for.
We have been discussing new science showing human influence has intensified extreme precipitation in North America. You can find links to the paper and our discussion in my weekly show blog, published Wednesdays at ecoshock.org. Our guest is Dr. Megan Kirkmeyer-Young from the government-funded agency Environment and Climate Change Canada. Megan, thank you for helping us understand this science and a little bit more about our future.
Sure, thanks for having me.
I'm Alex Smith for Radio EcoShock. Please pass this program on to your friends. Get it free at ecoshock.org. And join me again next week.
Visual sight in France. Visual sight on the seas and oceans. We shall fight with growing confidence and growing strength in the air, we shall never surrender until in God's good time the new world with all its power and might steps forth to the rescue and the liberation of the old world.